go. Check. Keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling. When you feeling them flares, they can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch a scenario, my stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no, through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah, just nod your head with it. So explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it. No scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool. Hear my heartbeat beating to the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind. Oh no, it's ponderoso, dope. So no overdose, cause it's dope. Yo, man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd. No, we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio. Once again with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you for tuning in, and we're happy you're joining us. We're broadcasting live from San Diego here in the Anti-Media Studio with a few special guests here. First off, we have SM Gibson, our co-host from Tuesday and Thursday. How you doing, man?
Doing good, man. How you doing?
Not too bad. Just enjoying this Memorial Day, I guess you can say. The weather sucks around here for the first time in a while, but it's been bad for 3 weeks now. But
I brought it with me.
We had a nice warm winter. It was like summer, but here in San Diego, you know, every now and then you get this overcast weather. We need the rain, but... make sure you join us Monday through Friday here on UCY, and check out any of the shows you missed. You can find us on YouTube, UCY TV. You can find us on our website, The Anti-Media. Go to the radio tab and you can catch us there as well. I'm also joined by a few other guests here in the studio. We have Carrie Butler. She's a journalist with The Anti-Media. How are you doing, Carrie?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And we're also joined by another special guest, Nick Nahara. He's a... Navy veteran, he's joining us on the show tonight. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Man, well, we're glad you're here. So, you know, Memorial Day obviously is today, and it's mostly a day about kind of remembering the people that have fallen in wars and, you know, the people that have given the ultimate sacrifice. And there's been a lot of them. I mean, the Civil War comes right off the top of the head, and that's where this whole Memorial Day really comes from. And, you know, there was like over 1 million Americans that died in that war, and, you know, it was just a horrible catastrophe, especially when you're seeing people within your own country killing each other. And, you know, war is bad enough as it is when you're fighting other countries, you know, to fight your own land, and fight on your own land is even worse. But anyway, first I want to just give a little short introduction into the roots of Memorial Day. And it initially started off as Decoration Day, and it came about in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. And basically what it was initiated by former slaves to celebrate emancipation and commemorate those who died for the cause. And, you know, to celebrate everyone that fought for that idea of, you know, freeing the slaves, because that's, you know, slavery is probably the most egregious thing that humans do to each other. And, you know, it kind of makes sense that you want to celebrate anybody that, you know, fought against that. But, you know, now we come about to the modern day Memorial Day, and it's kind of turned into one of these, just another one of these mainstream holidays where people are expected to go out and eat a bunch of food and drink a bunch of beer and salute the flag and all that good stuff. And, you know, people, I guess, fail to really understand what it's all about and the, you know, what's actually going on with the people that fight in these wars and why are they fighting them, and, you know, and why are there so many people dead or hurt coming back from all these, you know, places around the world that our government is putting people into, you know, these places of danger, putting their lives in danger. And that's one of the reasons why we brought Nick on the program tonight, is because you served in the military, and I know you have a unique perspective as far as, you know, what it means to, you know, what Memorial Day means, and, you know, what people, you know, the way people celebrate it, and, you know, why there's so many people that need to be memorialized because they have fallen and all that stuff. So I guess I want to start off with you, and just maybe if you could just give us your opinion as to what Memorial Day means to you.
Memorial Day means to me to honor specifically those that have fallen in fighting for you know, freedom for this country, I guess, if that's what you want to call it, is freedom. But that's what Memorial Day means to me. On Memorial Day, I like to remember one of my, you know, fellow veterans who wasn't even a victim of some sort of, you know, violence in the Middle East or something that typical of veterans. He was just smoking on the side of a ship, and he fell over and smashed his face in on the side of the ship. And that's really how I remember a Memorial Day for me more than anything. He was a good guy, and he left a couple of kids behind. And they're out there in Mississippi right now. And it just makes me appreciate my life more for having even survived that in the first place, because I had made a conscious effort to put myself in that situation in the first place. And, you know, like silly, you know, things like that happen. And it makes me appreciate my life much more. You know, I have a couple of little girls, and I came out of the military alive because some people don't, unfortunately, don't make it. And I feel much more appreciative of life, I guess. A lot more thankful and grateful for it all, to be able to experience this.
Nice, man. That was a great introduction, and sorry about what happened to your friend. And, you know, I've also got a personal family member of mine that's been affected in a pretty messed up way by the wars, and of course, other people in my family previously. My grandpa on my dad's side was drafted into the Korean War.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, back then it was, you're forced to fight. It's not a question of if.
Yeah.
Or whatever. It was like, hey, you guys are, if your name gets called, you're going. If you're poor, you're going.
That's,
you
know, pretty interesting.
If you can't come up with an excuse like Mitt Romney did, you're going to go fight. You know what I mean? And so, to me, today I kind of think about that kind of stuff, and the stuff that, how war has affected my family and stuff. And it's ugly. You know what I mean? It's really ugly. And,
it is ugly.
And so, the meme that we led with today, as far as for the radio show, is really talking about how, if we really wanted to support the people that are in the military, or the veterans, or the people that have served, and the people that have died, we should be looking at these politicians that have been sending a lot of our guys into harm's way in many times, you know, for either trumped up reasons or made up reasons, or because of false flags, or, you know, all kinds of different things that they've done or used as an excuse to get us into all these different wars and stuff. And that's where I kind of want to start out here, is how do I want to celebrate Memorial Day? It's by having less people dying in wars.
Well, Nick, let me interject real quick. You know, I'm real big on and giving everybody the stats so we, you know, can actually educate people. And they list 4,425 American soldiers that have died in Operation Iraqi Freedom, and another 2,355 soldiers that have died in Operation Enduring Freedom, which is basically Afghanistan. And those are people that did not have to die. And, you know, today, you know, we remember them, but it's so sad to think that these men lost their life for really trumped up, ridiculous reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to feel for the families and you know, you blame the politicians, you blame the corporations that definitely push this agenda. But we're talking about, you know, almost 7,000 Americans that have died for absolutely no reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's
for the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. Sorry, is that caller from 941?
Yeah, it is. I've just been listening, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. We're just getting through the intros here. We're also joined now by our co-host, DB Schwartz. How you doing, DB?
Doing good, Nick. Just listening and want to tell Nick in studio, thanks for your service, man. We'd be probably a lot worse off today if the military didn't have good people in it, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I really do. Yeah, I mean, I'm just focused now on, I guess you could say, like kind of reaping the benefits from what I contributed, and now I want to, you know, in turn, I plan on educating the youth somehow, whether it be at a professional level, or whether I start like my own business of some sort, but I plan on educating back to the youth, you know, the way that I generally wasn't educated about the realities of involving myself with the military, you know.
And we're also joined on the line by Manny Aguilar. How you doing, Manny?
What's up, Nick? Something like that. Yeah, Memorial Day as a veteran reminds me of why a veteran went out there supposedly to fight for freedom and, you know, basically 2, 4, 6, 8, what the hell we're fighting for, you know?
Oh, I definitely understand. Don't get me wrong. I feel like education on is the key, like most important of all of this. Cause like I no doubt I understand both sides of the spectrum, having been through it. And I just kind of I feel like education is probably the most important thing as far as it, like education about like the realities of exactly what you would really be going through, not just exactly, you know, you'll get this job and you'll get this bonus and you'll go into this department and everything will be reasonable. You know, it's the military has gotten to a point now where it's anybody can do any job and it doesn't matter because you'll end up wherever in the hell you want. You know, nothing's guaranteed no more. And I think those types of realities need to be exposed and explained to the youth as well as the, you know, benefits as well. I'm just really, really about, you know, educating the, you know, I guess, grim realities of it, but at the same time, the positive aspects of enduring that challenge and what you could benefit from on the and the end spectrum of it all.
Yeah, man. It's just reality, you know, and the thing is that there's so much propaganda involved in recruitment, and I mean, they're in the high schools and stuff. You know, I remember back in high school, they'd several times a year, I think, they'd come and they'd recruit kids out of the high schools and stuff. And my family member was recruited at 17 years old, and the war really, you know, we're talking about, you know, some of the people that come back with PTSD and that kind of thing, and you know, my family is affected by that. And one of the things, and why I'm so big on trying to prevent people from having to go through that, and don't get me wrong, I think being, you know, having self-defense is a really good thing, but I think at the same time we have to acknowledge when we're putting people in harm's way needlessly. And we're going to go, there's a story that we just put out today that kind of goes into that as well. But one of the reasons why I'm so, you know, interested in preventing these wars and stuff is because of the way that the veterans are treated when they come back. I mean, you know, I know people that had to wait, you know, 6 months for the VA to even treat or see them for a doctor's appointment for a serious condition and, you know, serious health issues. And it's just, you know, a huge bankruptcy, you know, and there was that the story recently out of Arizona that broke about the VA and how they were literally screwing these veterans over like no other, and like people were dying because of it. And these are all guys that many of them were Vietnam veterans and Iraq veterans that put their lives on the line, and when they get home, the government just shits on them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so that to me is one of the hugest things. It's like, dude, you promise these guys all this stuff with all this propaganda and all this. From day one, you're basically, you know, it's put into you that this is a thing to do. But, and you know, all these politicians and all these people are like, oh, yeah, we support the troops and this, that, and the other. Like, well, what about when they get home?
Mm-hmm.
You still support them when they get home, when they're no longer of use to you? I mean, when it's them that now needs you? You know what I'm saying? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, now we don't want to really deal with that. You know, it's like, when we need them, yeah, we support them and stuff. But now that they need us, like, nah.
Look at how they treated the veterans after Vietnam. It was, you know, really bad. But, Nick, I want to ask you a question, because I know the military, you know, it seems like for especially a lot of disadvantaged youth and just, you know, even young adults and whatever, it seems like the military is an option to kind of escape where you're currently at, and you see an opportunity to, you know, you possibly go get an education, you get to see the world, you get a steady paycheck. From your experience, what would you tell somebody who is maybe right now looking to join the military, just as, not because, you know, my family was in it and I was raised this way, but as an escape to get out of their everyday life?
I guess I would have to tell them, I would have to, you know the person a little bit, you know, obviously, and then make their compare their life and what's going on with the realities of the military, and see if I could get it through to them, best that it might be a good choice, because it's full of, you know, sacrifice, and depending on how that person is, that they're in their life, I mean, it may be a good thing for them to do, and it may not, you know. That's something you'd have to talk about, you know, the violence that's involved, about a lot of the paranoia that's involved, a lot of the, how do I say, it's like, I feel like those are probably some of the most important things that need to be informed, you know. I need to inform whoever I'm speaking to theoretically about these types of things, because I feel like that's not what's being expressed to the youth. Like me, for example, I didn't know that there was financial aid available to me so directly. That's the reason why I never really walked into a college and fill out a FAFSA or anything like that. I wish I had some sort of mentorship in my, which I understand on a grander scale nowadays is, you know, some of them are underfunded in the state of California. You know, had there been like an adequate mentorship program or something like that, that would, you know, inform me of realities in a more like professional manner, in a way like that, of that sort, something like that, then maybe I would have thought twice and weighed my options. Because the reason I joined was because I didn't want to burden my mother of having to pay my school bills, you know. So I made a conscious decision as a man, you know, being educated by my mom, actually, because my grandfather was in the military as well, and he was forced to go into the military during, he was Mexican American, he was forced to go in the military at the time because of the current political situation. So you know, I really think that informing the youth and educating them about these types of things, about, you know, sometimes you will be away from your family, sometimes you will have to sacrifice certain things, but you must know these things as you make a collective conscious effort going into it. A lot of times, like when you get in the recruitment process, I notice how some things go sneaky under the radar, and I'm pretty sure some of my veterans that are out there listening to this know exactly what I'm talking about, as far as living conditions and what the realities of the military is really like. You know, some of these guys are just trying to get quotas so that way they can keep their job month to month and that they can get the contract after their first term is up and blase, blase. So I think those types of things need to be expressed to the youth as well. So,
do you believe that a lot of, you know, maybe not so much in general because you can't speak for every case.
Yes.
But with a lot of people you knew and you were in the service with, do you think a lot of those people would have signed up if they would have known their opportunities and had everything kind of laid out to them beforehand?
I can speak only for myself on this, you know, I'm seriously, but I would say that a lot of, the majority of the people that I know now that I'm out of the military, you know, come from similar backgrounds, and they, you know, most of them that we congregate with, they do agree. You know, with a slight few to the side, you know, but I say more like a 70-30, honestly. And yeah.
So, one of the, you touched on it briefly there. One of the main factors going in, and this again, this goes back to what has affected my family too. Was financial hardship, people really feeling like, look, I'm not doing anything else and it's hard as hell to get a job and shit. And well, the next best thing is joining up with the military. And that's exactly what happened in my family. And, you know, so what you're bringing up with the education and stuff, it's huge. And I think the economics really plays a huge part here because the fact that we have a relatively messed up economy, and then you also mentioned the tuition prices.
Yes.
combining understanding that the economy is relatively unbalanced. I mean, we're talking about massive wealth inequality that's been growing and growing and growing and shows no sign of slowing down. I mean, we're talking about the poorest of the poor getting even worse and the very few that are extremely rich just getting richer. And so as that cycle continues, I think we're going to continue to see people turning to the military for economic reasons. And it's one thing that shouldn't be, you know, overlooked with this whole thing is that a lot of people, at least from their perception, don't really have a choice but to join up. You
yes.
know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so that's why I wouldn't say mad, but I disagree when I see people, you know, talking all this shit about the troops and the people that are fighting. In many ways, like, it's not their choice to really be in that situation. It's just that they kind of end up there and they get taken advantage of by the whole system that's going on, the recruitment process, the propaganda, the advertising, all that stuff. It's sometimes it can be extremely aggressive when they're trying to meet quotas and things like that. So I want to touch on that and maybe talk about what can be done to help kids, like, economically, that are in, like, situations that are pretty desperate, you know, where they're facing, you know, maybe homelessness and things like that if they don't join up because there is no economic opportunity. What can we do to, like, improve those chances for these young people to come out and, you know, be able to have other choices? What do you think?
Well, me personally, I'm speaking for myself, and I hope that other veterans that are listening out there think alike. You know, I feel advantageous to come out of what I've been through. And I feel like right now I need to use this opportunity to get all the schooling that I can get, so that way I can excel to a position of where I can educate and teach via a high school or a college or something of that sort. So that way I can you generate the income that is necessary for me to look into establishing youth centers around my local area and, you know, developing, getting a taste for what the local area really, really desires by partnering with schools and local councils and getting good ideas on what to build around my communities. In all honesty, that's the way that I feel. That's the way that I want to excel to this. And then in turn, using these community centers or places that the youth can gather and congregate and celebrate and know that they have the right to assembly, I feel like that really, really, really is the key for me personally, I think, and
I definitely agree with you, man, because I think the whole reason why we have this massive inequality and people in these desperate situations that lead them into making, you know, choices that they should have had other choices to pick from as well, is because we have this overly centralized economic system that's top-down pyramid scheme, led by the banks and the Fed, and just trickled down to the rest of us from there. And what you said there about community and building community and building places of where people can interact and ideas can be formed, you know, these are like the taverns of the old days. I mean, nowadays we're just talking about places for people to gather where they're not being held down, because that's the thing, man. Everywhere you go nowadays, it's like all these rules, and you can do this, you can't do that, you can't, no skateboards on the sidewalk, no this, no that. I mean, it's just like so many different things that you can and can't do. I mean, people just need a place where they can openly, freely talk about ideas, not being spied on, not being eavesdropped on, not being controlled, and things like that. And I think that's what we need in these communities, to like renew the economic versatility that we used to have. It's been sucked out by all these huge corporations that have now monopolized on almost every aspect of our lives. But looking at it as the pyramid scheme that it is, the best way to work back out from it is through local economic activity.
Yes.
That's being done through the community. And I think that is a great, that's a great way of putting it, is building it through the youth, through the education at the community level. And this all, many ways leads back to economics. And that's one of the things about these wars and why we end up in so many of them is, these wars are good economics for some people. But for the rest of us, the people that pay the bill for the war, I mean, it's not a good investment, but for companies like maybe Halliburton and, places like that, it's a good investment. They spent a couple $1 million lobbying the government. They put their guy, Dick Cheney, in office, and they say, hey, go bomb Iraq, and they go make a bunch of billions of dollars, and then everybody pays for it. And so this cycle kind of reflects back to what we were just talking about, is like they're sucking all this money out of the communities in order to go finance the wars. And at the same time, they're creating a bunch of people with no economic choices that have to turn to joining the military to make ends meet. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So it's I think the building local community and economy and like open marketplaces and trading and bartering and doing things like that, just innovative, economics, that itself is one part of the puzzle that we need to start reining in this military-industrial complex and all of these horrible things that are going on.
Now, Nick, I have a devil's advocate kind of question here, because being in San Diego and you drive around, this town is definitely economically influenced with the military-industrial complex. I mean, everywhere you go,
this is the most militarized city I've ever been to.
Right.
Yes.
I've never been to like DC. I don't know how DC is, but
it's not El Paso too.
It's massively militarized. Yeah, military helicopters overhead, like all the time.
And
yesterday we
saw the warfare systems place. I mean, it's just everywhere. Everywhere you go, you see it. Now, my question is, what do you think the economy? Because the economy of San Diego seems to be doing very well, but obviously that's what's funding it.
Exactly.
How do you believe the economy of San Diego would be without that military-industrial complex?
Well, man, there's various estimates of how much economic activity is spurred by like government or like military spending. Because the other thing you have to keep in mind, we've got a place up in northeastern San Diego County called Drone Valley. This is where like Northrop Grumman and like all these big drone manufacturers are out there. And so like we make the drones too. We build the ships. We build the boats for the jets and for the missiles. And Raytheon has an office less than a mile from here.
It's probably 80%, right, Nick, wouldn't you think?
The economy, I mean, yeah, man. I mean, there's been estimates. I mean, I know it's above 50% of the economy of San Diego County is based on military spending.
That's huge.
And, if that all ended overnight, there'd be, a huge issue. And, we've been through it here in Chula Vista before. Right after World War II, they banned hemp. We used to grow all the hemp right here in Chula Vista for all the hemp needs they needed for World War II. Mm-hmm. And then they came, the war ended, and they banned hemp. And then the economy, oh, what the hell are we going to do? You know, and so then, but at that same time, the military industrial complex moved into this area. And then all the people that were formerly growing hemp, growing citrus, and growing food all started working in the manufacturing plants down on the bayfront where they were making the missiles and all that stuff. And, you know, the stuff is still there. They're not manufacturing anymore. They're still doing research and development. But it would be a, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, and it really floods the economy with a lot of cash. You know, but it kind of goes back to, once again, it brings us to this stark difference, this money that is there for some people and then it's just gone for the rest. So what we see here in San Diego, and this is kind of a unique thing here, is we got these massive amounts of billions of dollars being spent in military spending for research and development, manufacturing, shipbuilding, drone making, you know, all that stuff. I mean, there's probably several hundred thousand people employed by it, you know, and there's all that money flowing there, right? But then at the same time, you flip the coin over here in San Diego County and you find out that we have the highest per capita homelessness population in the country.
I will say, if I should be homeless, I would move to San Diego because it's beautiful.
I mean, we have nice weather, but outside of that factor, 40% of the homeless in San Diego County are military veterans.
Wow.
Yep.
40%. So it goes back. We talked about it a little bit ago about how the VA treats people like shit and how it's a bureaucratic nightmare. And then we start looking at these veterans that are just completely screwed out of the system. And they've actually been criminalized, man. These guys they're homeless because they've been injured, whether physically or mentally, by the Vietnam War, by the Iraq War, even Korean War. There's still some guys out there that are still survivors of the Korean War. And then they're just basically put out to pasture. Like, they're not our problem anymore. They already run their course. They served our purpose. Now they're too much of an expense. Just put them out there. And I mean, I'm personally dealing with that right now.
Yes.
With my family, dude. And it's really messed up. And it's
really sad.
It is really sad, man. And so what we see is like plenty of spending. And it's like, oh, yeah, as long as they're still active duty and, you know, they're still going to go. If we tell them they're still going to go out there and put their necks on the line for us. Cool. As soon as they're done with them, whatever.
And here's something I think everybody here can agree on is I don't think these people should be sent to war in the first place, at least not with the war that we've been presented with. But if you're going to do that, these people need to come back and be treated right.
Yes.
You know, they need to be taken care of because there's a lot of people, and it's not everybody, but, you know, PTSD seems like a very serious issue, and nobody's trying to care for that or take care of it. They want to just throw some pills in their direction. And how is that really helping people? They don't want to, you know, build them back up. They just want to.
Honestly, man, like I sit here and witness this stuff firsthand, and I see what the VA is doing, and I see them not even trying to like cure people or like give them the actual treatment, like the therapy and counseling and that kind of stuff. They don't even focus on that. It's not even mandatory, man. And that's what they need to like be able to get people to be better and start reeling them back from all these drugs so that they can start weaning them off of the prescription pills. Dude, according to what I've seen firsthand at the VA, they're not interested in that. They're interested in keeping people on pills for basically the rest of their lives. And then you start wondering, okay, well, then you wonder, like, well, why in the hell would they want to do that? That doesn't make any sense. Well, then you start thinking big pharma. You start thinking lobbying. You start thinking regulatory capture. You start thinking people that are in charge of the VA are probably coming from the healthcare industry, maybe. That's what's happening, you know, and they're not trying to help these guys and help them like actually heal. And a lot of these guys could be healed.
Right.
And I think I honestly think people in my family could be healed too. But that's not the priority, man. The priority is making sure these guys are taking these pills.
Right. So Nick, yeah. Somebody that's been and you know, given your time to this country,
mm-hmm.
How would you, if you were in charge of receiving veterans back home, how would you approach that?
I got one simple solution, and for me, that is legalized marijuana. I can't say it enough, because the only way that we can eliminate it is by attacking these pharmaceutical industries and showing them alternative methods to healing at the same time in really educating the public about it. But I think marijuana would probably have to be the first step. And yes, I am speaking from experience. And
hey, you're in California. We're one of the lucky states that actually allows people to...
Yeah, I'm completely speaking from experience, because when I can completely attest to that, because I had a unique experience happen to me when I got out of the Navy. Before I got into a little bit of trouble, before I got my honorable discharge, they tried to say that I signed a document that I didn't sign on the ship, and that that was required for them to not look like they were making a false, you know, statement against themselves. And that that put me in quite a bind. And had I been actually participated in what they were referring to as a welcome home program and educating me about what was available to me, then things might have been different. When I got out of the military and I went to visit the VA and told them what was wrong with me, instead of having scheduled me for a counseling session or anything of that sort, they immediately referred me to the doctor, and the doctor prescribed me pills. Like, it took me less than a day. It was actually pretty amazing. I scheduled the appointment on base, and then less than a day they were calling me. I was in there. I got the pills the next day.
Pretty efficient.
Yes, this was in Oxnard when I got out at Port Hueneme, on base here in California. So I think, and I didn't take the pills because my mom, you know, thank God, was educated, and she's a pharmaceutical tech. I called her up and I said, hey mama, you know, listen and tell me what you think, because I got these things going on, mama, but like I don't know what to do, mama. And she said, you know, Nick, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and be careful with whatever you do. And I said, okay, well, I know what to do. And I made my decision was not to take the pills, and I looked for alternative methods into healing, into the problems that I had going on at the time, an emotional and physical experience that I you know, really don't want to talk about. But it helped, it healed me, honestly.
One solution would be a reform, just completely at the day, and be more hands-on with everybody coming back. Do you think that would fix a lot of this?
Yes, and I we need to look at the scandals that are going on with the VA all over the United States. It's
corruption, man. It's just massive corruption in the VA.
It's ridiculous, and I'm disgusted, and I'm absolutely glad I didn't take those pills. And you know, it's specifically the reform in the hospitals. You know, they don't seem to have a problem distributing the money to me every time I need to go to school every month. So there are things that we need to look at within the Veterans Affairs system. I completely agree. Like, yeah, that's, yeah, complete reform. We need to have better standards at interviewing potential employees within the Veterans Affairs system in the first place. We need to have a better HR department. These are just my suggestions, but if I, you know, I'm just saying, like, these kind of things need to be brought up and have attention paid to them very much more carefully. And that's just the way that I feel about it.
Well, I have a question, because it seems that like a recurring problem is that there's no accountability. So whether we're dealing with the defense manufacturers and all of the contracts that go to them that are then spurring war, or whether we're talking about ignoring veterans, a consistent theme is that there's no accountability. So how do we force that on them? For any of you, I'm just curious, because I don't have the answer.
Accountability is key, right? And that's
everything.
Though. Like police accountability, government accountability, individual accountability. I mean, it goes from the top to the bottom. It's scaled all the way.
And really, I mean, we talk about the problems with this country. I think that's the biggest problem facing this country. We talk about the VA. We talk about the Congress. We talk about the police. All anybody's ever been asking for this entire time is accountability from the top to the bottom. And we don't get it anywhere.
I mean, that's why people at the DMV are so rude, or parking enforcement. It's like every single institution of government, they know that there's nothing we can do. We're beholden to them. They take our money. They decide the services. They quote-unquote represent us, and we have to sit around and just accept it.
And they aren't held accountable. And as much as I don't like the Hillary Clinton email scandal, and how much as much as I think it's a distraction, even something that minor, if an individual in this room were to do that, or any regular person out there that's not part of this elite establishment group, we would have been held accountable. I mean, we'd probably go to jail or prison for a long time because of it. But a person does that and they're able to still run for the presidency of the United States. It's like, what in the hell are we? Where in the hell is the equal application of the law, man? It's not there.
When militias start policing the police, that's when.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It's like, I think radical actions will push the reform. I don't want to individually, you know, advocate for any certain action, but militias, I think, are a you know, one part of society that the government, that helps keep the government in check in many ways. The government is worried about militias, you know, because there's so many of them, and the ranks are actually growing by the day too.
Yes.
And so that is a part of the equation that would help hold these guys accountable.
And they'd be paranoid of organized stuff like that. Nick, look what they're doing, just these petty biker gangs in Texas infiltrating them. I mean, they're going to crush any possible source of dissent, but if it's everybody deciding we're done with it, what are they going to do? Where are they going to cash their checks?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, man. And you know, the cops are basically taking the, you know, these are the guys that are tasked with holding everybody and holding everything in place, right? And, you know, who knows what it's going to take before the cops finally lay down their arms and finally say, okay, enough is enough. You know, someday it would probably happen, but I mean, who knows? But back to this topic of trying to prevent people from having to go die in foreign countries over things that are like not founded in reality, is this story on the anti-media that I wanted to get to about how basically the former deputy director, Michael Morell, basically admitted that the information that he was relaying over to the Bush administration prior to the invasion of Iraq was that they had no belief or even suspected Saddam Hussein of doing anything that the Bush administration claimed that they were doing. So basically what this guy is saying is, like, the intelligence was saying this is what isn't happening. And then while at the same time, George Bush and Dick Cheney and all of their talking heads were getting on TV and saying, well, no, this is what's happening. And Saddam Hussein is about to invade the world and kill everybody. And that's what they convinced everybody of. And after 9/11, it was such a frenzy and everyone was so scared. And oh, my God, where's it going to happen next? It was like, man, they could get us to believe anything. And it's like Osama bin Laden took, you know, took credit for it, but hey, we're going to go into Iraq anyway.
And really, how they sold Iraq was saying maybe Hussein wasn't involved with 9/11, but he's a very bad man, so it could happen again because of him.
Then at least it would have been honest.
Right.
You know what I mean? But I don't think that, see, the people wouldn't have...
But that's how I think, it subconsciously, people agreed with going over into Iraq.
Yeah, man, exactly. So, this guy admits that it was basically all a lie. And there's just so many ways to go on this, and it's just such a sad thing, you know, because a lot of these people that are being memorialized, you talked about the numbers earlier, the people that have died from Iraq, in Iraq, and the thousands of people. And then also there was like a report that came out several weeks ago that talked about how many Iraqi people have died since it started. And it was like over 1 million people.
Yeah.
You know, and so like all this loss of life, and it was all based on a few guys that made a couple bullshit lies, dude.
Right.
Because they were...
And the crazy thing was, a lot of it, at least half of it, was what they considered non-violent as a result of people not getting food and water. I guess that wasn't a violent death, so it's categorized differently.
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue that not getting food and water is more violent than getting shot. I mean, that's a worse way to die.
Yes.
Getting shot's a relatively easy way of going out. Starving or, like, not having clean water to drink, and now that sucks.
I tell you, there was a story I wanted to bring up since, you know, today's Memorial Day, and it's on the Fifth Column News about Sergeant James Brown. I don't know if y'all heard about this story. He was the veteran that did two tours in Iraq, and he ended up in jail over court fines. And they left him in an isolated cell, and he was trying to get the officer's attention that he had a history of PTSD. And at which point he started bleeding, and the officers came in there, and it's all on camera, and it's kind of a gray thing, but they tie him up and they beat him to death. They kill him, like they torture the guy. He's dead. This is a veteran. Like, you know, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't be paying attention to the crazy cases of Michael Brown and Tamir Rice, because those are horrible. But, you know, people say, we want to honor the veterans. We want to honor the veterans. You know, the same people that are saying, oh, screw Michael Brown, oh, he was thug. You know, these people are like, we love the veteran. We, you know, we salute the flag. Where are they on this one?
Mm-hmm.
Where's Sean Hannity on this one? The police just kill a veteran.
It goes back to what we've been talking about, man.
This should be the
and
top story
and
on
it's,
Fox News.
It's that
what they say they believe in.
Veterans are only supported out of convenience, dude. And these guys, when it's politically advantageous, which means when it comes to, you know, supporting the troops and all this, that, and the other, they're all for it. But when it comes to actually paying for, you know, the war and paying for the people to go to this war and helping them, you know, come back into society afterwards, that's when it's like, oh, now we got to spend money. Now we got to spend money on this, and that's not going to look good in our budget, because we've already spent most of our money fighting the war anyway, you know. And so how are we going to pay all the money to help all the people
that
come back?
But they're probably paying $300 for a hammer and giving it to Halliburton, but they don't want to, you know, give the money back to the people that actually use these weapons, that, you know, carried out the acts which gave them all that money.
Yeah, it's hypocrisy at its finest, basically. But going back into, like, the recent wars, not just Iraq and, of course, Afghanistan, but, you know, all the stuff that's gone on since then, before then and after World War II, a lot of that stuff didn't really have to happen. Korea, Vietnam, all the meddling we've done in South America, Central America, a lot of that stuff never really had to take place.
Right.
And it was all based, once again, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people have heard about the Gulf of Tonkin. It's one of those conspiracy theories that actually came true. And it's the reason why the Vietnam War officially started.
And then the false flag that never happened, the Bay of Pigs, right?
I mean, I don't know much about the Bay of Pigs, but this was, you know, this was the whole Vietnam War was based on a falsehood, the very beginning of it.
Well, it was a technical beginning, because you have to remember that there had been escalation over in Vietnam, and we had already, you know, given some advisors over to them. They were engrossed in a civil war, and we had gone over there to keep communism out of South Vietnam. And then it appeared that Johnson was looking for an excuse to heavily involve us, and didn't really think he could portray that message to the American people just by saying the word communism. So he had to make it look like American lives were attacked, which the American people would then go, do what you got to do.
Yeah, man, exactly.
And for me, I think that really speaks to the fact that so many politicians have to lie to get people to accept war. It sounds really negative, and it's awful that it's perpetrated all the time, but I think it also really speaks to the fact that people are really peaceful. They have to be lied into war. They aren't warmongering. They don't want people dying. They don't want troops going and killing others. They don't want troops dying. And the fact that politicians have to go to such lengths to convince people of that, it's depressing, but I think it's also a positive thing, because if people were given the truth, maybe they wouldn't be so quick to endorse violence. And obviously it's a different problem to have to address getting out that truth. And that's, I think, what we try to do at Anti-Media and what so many people try to do. But as depressing as it is, I really think it is a positive thing. Because, I mean, George Bush campaigned really on non-interventionism. And it wasn't until all of these lies came out that people were ready to go to war.
George Bush had a great 1999. I mean, he legitimately did. It was when he got in office and then September 11th happened. It just...
People are relatively peaceful. They just don't get the right message. Like, they see this crap on CNN and it's like, oh my God, ISIS is in Texas and we're being invaded already, so let's go start bombing people. And people are like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So we're going to keep ourselves safe. And
what's really going to happen if the threat does come from south of the border and we do get hit with something? I mean, that's exactly what they're setting us up for, man. It's always a pretext.
Damn, dude.
I mean, even World War II was a pretext. Like, most American... I used to tutor a girl in history at Beverly Hills High School, and I was reading through her history book, and they make no mention of the fact that FDR had promised Winston Churchill that he was going to get America into the war. They don't talk about the economic sanctions against Japan. They just talk about the fact that Japan attacked, and it was unprovoked, and therefore we had to go to war. And so this war that's really been glorified is the entire reason that America... is able to have its exceptionalism even was based on lies. So what does that say about really the value of war?
And this is, you know, kind of conspiracy and kind of not, though. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that the United States was aware that Pearl Harbor was going to happen.
Well, they didn't care. I mean, it was what we needed.
Give them an excuse to go into the war.
I mean, it's been pretty textbook nowadays where it's like...
Here's the difference, though. I don't think Japan attacking the United States was some manufactured thing. I do believe they may have, you know, rolled over on the information. It seems like, though, today people aren't necessarily willing to come in and just attack us because they know what will happen to their country. So the United States has to manufacture these crises themselves to give them an excuse to go over there.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of the trouble in the Middle East, a lot of the unrest, is, you know, stuff that takes place after U.S. intervention, and, you know, we see Libya disintegrating, you know, Syria, obviously, Iraq, you know, we had just pulled out of there, and Obama basically said that we won and all that stuff, and like as soon as we leave, it's like there's ISIS, you know what I mean? And so, a lot of this stuff is just being created out of this blowback or reaction from U.S. policy, where we go and take out a guy like Saddam Hussein and leave a massive power vacuum in its place, and then it's just the trouble is just going to keep continuing over and over again.
Well, there's documents that have come out in the past few days that were released by judicialwatch.org, you know, and that's up to you, you know, to trust that site, but the documents, you know, are from the Department of Defense and do say we realize the problem that we could get with the rise of the Islamic State, but it's something we're willing to deal with if it lets us overthrow Assad and go into Syria. And it's almost like they were trying to trade one bad guy for another. Well, we'll deal with ISIS, let him overthrow Assad first.
And it's all the grand chessboard, because Syria falling leads to Iran, which leads to Russia, which leads to China, and then it's hegemony.
Yeah, man. I mean, it really does. Like, a lot of these conflicts, they just break down to like geopolitics, and of course that was what was going on in Korea, and they were just trying to hold a beachhead. You know, they wanted to keep at least one place in near China where they had a beach access, where they could have ports, and where if they needed to invade the place, they could. You know, and that's really what it was all about. They said it was all about communism and we got to stop the spread of communism. Dude, that was on the other side of the freaking world in a tiny little country.
Yeah.
There is no way in hell we're going to go send off 50,000 guys to die in a war just because you want to stop a spread of a government ideology. That's insane. You know, and so it wasn't that was what they told us it was about. It's like, oh, it's communism. Just like nowadays, it's like, oh, now it's terrorism. It was Bin Laden. Now it's ISIS.
The dirtiest word in the world back then, and now it's terrorism. But at the time, it was the word communism.
Yeah, man.
Get away with anything.
The only thing that's changed over time is the excuse they're giving us for why we're doing what we do, in a lot of ways. And in the end, it's geopolitical. Whether it's about resources or positioning or whatever, you know, to maintain a strategic, you know, place. This is why they do what they do, and they have these bases where they have, you know, America has 1,000 bases, man. 1,000 military bases. you know, and so they're all over the place. They got them in Germany still. They got them in Japan still, Korea. I mean, you name the country outside of maybe Russia and China where there isn't a military
base. Here's
a
question. Do you think that the Roman Empire had 1,000 military bases spread out throughout the world? I don't know the answer to that.
They probably had several hundreds.
Right. So by the definition, we have a more expansive empire than even
militarily. We probably have the largest military of any empire in history.
And yet,
at least not the largest, empire. But the most powerful military
right.
ever. And more and more, and like this is where I kind of want to end the show with, because we only got like 4 minutes left. This is a trend I've been seeing, and this is the thing that's really scaring the hell out of me. Iraq was really unpopular because they had, you know, how many guys went through there? I think it was like over a million guys that had cycled through Iraq. A million U.S. Military people had served in Iraq, like not all at the same time, but like cycled through. But now what we're seeing going on in Iraq and in a lot of other places, it's like, well, there's no troops on the ground. Like, that's the key word. It's like, no troops on the ground. This is, we got to keep in mind that the fact that we keep hearing this phrase, we got to keep in mind, this is a propaganda term. No troops on the ground is propaganda. And I'll tell you what I see as the biggest threat to the coming years, because all the guys in the military are going to be completely screwed if this happens. And what I'm talking about is the fact that they really don't have to put as many troops on the ground anymore. They've got a shitload of drones, and keep in mind, the drones are getting more advanced by the day.
Yes.
And if anybody out there has been keeping tabs on DARPA, these guys are already got, they've already got robots that will go out there and run around.
We've got a story
up
today, talking about they're basically going G.I. Joe and going to have lasers.
That's exactly what I'm trying to get to here, man, is that in the future, there could be World War III and it would be no troops on the ground. It's going to be literally robots and drones and all this stuff fighting, and that removes the human element out of the war. And that's really deadly on both sides, because for the people that are, like, if this happens to us in the U.S., we're all going to be so detached from it that we're never even going to see any of our own people dying, that we're not even going to give two shits.
But can I tell you one flaw that kind of works not in our favor? Robots are really good at taking out civilians, and they're not the greatest at fighting troops firing back with EMP, particle beams, and all that kind of crap. So when you're talking about not that many boots on the ground, there's just going to be a lot of drones hitting indiscriminate civilian masses. That's what it's going
to
be.
Exactly, man. That's the other side of the equation that I wanted to talk about, is the more and more that we start using drones, the less and less human conscious is behind these guns. And so it's not a guy sitting there saying, okay, there's a kid right there, so I'm not going to shoot in that direction, even though there's a target right there. Or you got a drone just saying, nope, boom, just shoot it, no conscious, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, it gets even more deadly for the people on the other side of the equation that are getting attacked by the drones. They're basically helpless, and even if they do shoot them down, they're not even taking down anybody. They're just taking down a couple, you know, they're just taking down that piece of equipment. You know, this is the future of warfare that we're going to start seeing, and this no boots on the ground thing is going to be driven home like no other. I don't think that any of the next wars that we're going to fight are going to even have boots on the ground, dude. I really don't. Like, right now, they got just mostly advisors and stuff in Iraq. They got less than like 10,000 guys out there. And, it just goes to show the future of warfare is here, man. The drones are there. The drones are already flying over the U.S. Yeah, they're not armed yet, but they're already here. They're already there. They're on the other side of the world. They're blowing people up. And as soon as these drone armies take over, all the guys in the military are done. They're not even going to have to be, they're no longer needed. And what happens to the people in the military when they're no longer needed? We've seen it. The VA, the homelessness, the medical system. In a large part, some people are able to navigate through it, but in a large part, a lot of people are left behind by the system.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
crazy, man. This is something,
and it sounds like, here's the thing, like, come back.
Yeah. I'ma let
Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, 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 stereo.